Welcome to another episode of the Gunblog Variety Cast with your hosts, Sean Sorrentino and Aaron Paulette.
Welcome to episode 128 of the Gunblog Variety Cast, a proud member of the Self-Defense Radio Network. How are you doing, Aaron?
So I am scheduled to get that root canal on the 31st, which is something I am so looking forward to. Yay.
Okay, for words never spoken before, getting a root canal, looking forward to it.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I'll be getting it done. And the good news is that I've managed to work things out so I can have my teeth fixed and still attend Mag 40 next month. So in as much as anything involving dental surgery is good, this is good news.
Awesome. That's pretty cool. Now, I was cruising around Facebook while I was waiting for everything to, you know, get ready for getting everybody together, getting you in, some other stuff going on around here. So I'm like sitting at the desk and I tripped across, somebody had shared the Oconee County, Georgia Sheriff's Office Facebook, and it just cracked me up. It's cracked me up so bad, I just had to share it. If you just happen to find a bomb, an incendiary, a thermonuclear device, deadly chemicals, or anything of the sort, please do not put it in your vehicle and drive around with it. And most importantly, don't bring it to the sheriff's office. Call us. We know a guy. He'll come to you. None of the above applies to ammo. You can bring ammo.
Yeah, I was checking out their page, and they have a terms of use page as well, and it's equally funny. To report an item that needs immediate attention, call 911 for emergencies. Examples of things that need immediate attention are things on fire that shouldn't be on fire, people impaled with things which they would rather not be impaled, livestock running loose in the roadway, people running loose in the roadway, generally anything in the roadway that shouldn't be there, significant traffic hazards, people running off with things that don't belong to them, crimes in progress, medical emergencies, anything that makes you go, somebody should do something about that quickly. The above is not an exhaustive list. It is examples. Call an actual live person to report things that need immediate attention.
These guys remind me of the Bangor, Maine Police Department Facebook feed. You've seen some of those, right?
I believe I have, yes.
Oh, they do long form. It looks like the Oconee County, Georgia Sheriff's Office does short form humor, and the Bangor guys do long form. And I'm reliably informed it's Bangor, not Bangor. Weird was adamant on this. So I understand you're doing some pull-up stuff still.
Yes. Well, I mentioned however many episodes ago that my New Year's resolution was to be able to do a pull-up. And I bought the exercise bar that mounts in the doorway, and I've been working on it. And I've been working on this for about a month. And I'm proud to report that, well, no, I still can't do a pull-up. But what I can do here is, from a standing position, I reach up, I grab the bar, I can actually lift my feet off the floor a distance of about 7 inches. And I know that doesn't sound like much, but when I started, I reached up, grabbed the bar, pulled with all my might, my feet went up a little bit. I mean, you could really only tell they moved because the fact that they were no longer indenting the carpet. So the fact that I can lift my feet physically, visibly off the ground is progress.
I'm not sure I can do a pull-up anymore. I haven't tried in a long time, and I weigh a little more than I did. No, wait, that's not what happened. Gravity has increased a lot since the last time I had to do any pull-ups.
Probably around your midsection, I imagine.
Pretty much everywhere, but mostly there, yeah. So I received a Next Belt, NEXBELT, Next Belt, from the Next Belt company for testing and evaluation. This is, I think, maybe the second time I've ever gotten anything from anybody to test out.
Amateur.
It's made with what looks like ballistic nylon is the structural part of the belt, but it has a covering that looks a lot like leather, but isn't. My wife took a look. It's not leather. It's 1.5 inches wide, which is strange since I've been wearing 1.75 inch belt for like 8 years. Going to 1.5 inch belt, which is like a normal width belt for, you know, regular people, 1.5 inches, you know, in the tactical community, 1.5 inches is normal. 1.75 inches a little wide. But now I have a belt that'll go through the belt loops on my dress pants, so that's a plus. That tells you how often I wear dress pants, right? It's got a shiny buckle on it and does not look tactical. And that's what I wanted. They have several styles, including a Gadsden flag one and some plain nylon belts with a more military-style buckle if you want something to go with your 5'11 range pants, you know, if that sort of fashion is important to you. But I wanted something that would, you know, look normal. If I ever tucked my shirt in and people saw it, it's just this silver square belt buckle. This belt is kind of weird in that it doesn't have holes. You know, like belts have holes in them to adjust the size. It doesn't have any holes in it. It's got this weird ratchet assembly thing on the back. And the buckle, it has this, I mean, very difficult to describe, but there's a latch on it and it hooks into the ratchet on the back. And you can adjust it in quarter inch increments. So that's pretty cool.
It's kind of like a come along.
Yeah, I guess sort of like that. Like a little ratchet strap maybe.
Okay.
I don't know. Kind of cool. Take a look at it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to wear this belt every day for the next month and see what I think. I'm going to wear it at work. I'll carry my gun with it. I'll even shoot my next IDPA match wearing it. And in a month, I'm going to let you know what I think. If you'd like to see what they've got, check out www.nexbelt.com. That's NEXBELT.com.
And special thanks to Lucky Gunner and Remington for their support of the Gunblog Variety Cast. From Golden Saber to Range Rounds, get a full lineup of quality Remington ammo that ships fast at LuckyGunner.com.
All right, let's get on with the show.
Beth hates to ruin the fun for some of the women who walked on Washington recently, but men and women are different. Women are still the most victimized gender, and the most powerful voice for feminism should be the responsible female gun owner.
No matter who you are or how you look at it, we all have to come to the terms with the fact that women are still the more victimized gender. According to the National Institute of Justice and Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, one out of every six American women has been the victim of an attempted or completed rape in her lifetime. This means that every 107 seconds, a female in the U.S. is sexually assaulted. As well, statistics show that every 9 seconds, a woman in the U.S. is attacked or beaten. Every day, for women especially, there's a constant struggle with disparity of force. Just a reminder, disparity of force is the situation that any reasonable person would conclude places you at an overwhelming disadvantage in your effort to protect yourself against immediate and serious bodily injury. In other words, disparity of force means that you are at a disadvantage if someone is trying to hurt you. I, for one, am not okay with this. And as a woman, I want to be as prepared and as safe as I possibly can be. That's one reason I have a gun and why I train and learn everything I can about how to use a firearm for self-defense. Let's face it, guys are often bigger, stronger, and more aggressive than ladies. They're just made that way. That oftentimes gives them the upper hand. And more often than not, they know this. So they look for smaller, weaker prey. They look for the easy targets. And while I know that physically I may be weaker than an attacker, I also recognize that in these situations, a firearm can truly be an equalizer. And isn't that what so many people, feminists and liberals, are fighting for when it comes to women? Equality? The weird thing is, even though scores of folks claim to have the safety and well-being of women in mind, they still insist that women should disarm. Like Colorado Democrat Representative Joe Salazar, who commented that even if women feel like they might be attacked or raped, they may not be harmed, so who needs a firearm for protection? In fact, while arguing for the disarmament of college students, he stated, "It's why we have call boxes. It's why we have safe zones. It's why we have whistles. Because you just don't know who you're going to be shooting at, and you don't know if you feel like you're going to be raped, or if you feel like someone's been following you around, or if you feel like you're in trouble when you actually may not be, that you pop out that gun and you pop around at somebody." In this statement, Salazar basically claimed that women are idiots who are incapable of proper reasoning and who are unable to handle firearms safely. Salazar later apologized if his comments offended anyone, but apparently he'd rather a woman, perhaps even his own wife and daughters, just have a whistle handy in case of an attack. Sadly, Salazar is not alone in this line of thinking. These types of derisive comments have been popping up all over the place. Last year, Everytown for Gun Safety, a Michael Bloomberg-funded arm of the gun control lobby, shared several tweets suggesting that young women are too dumb to handle firearms. One tweet read, "You think your drunk college-age daughters are bad with their phones? Imagine them with guns." And women's magazines like Cosmopolitan have produced articles and videos highlighting, and perhaps even celebrating, women who are terrified of guns. According to a recent video series they created about dating a man with a gun, many women seem to believe that guns are quote-unquote scary death machines. And if a woman is in a relationship with a gun-owning man, then the relationship is destined to fail, since men who own guns are apparently domestic abusers. And the Second Amendment? That's just an old, pointless, archaic sentiment worthy of nothing more than an eye roll. Instead of supporting women and showing women as strong, empowered, and capable of taking care of themselves, these people and these organizations are making women look like nothing more than whimpering cowards who are irrational and helpless. But tell me this, gun grabbers. How many homicides, rapes, attacks, and assaults have occurred to females over these last few years? And how many of those could have been avoided or deterred by women using firearms in self-defense? Yes, I realize people think that if you have a gun, you're in greater danger of having it taken from you or used against you. In fact, people want to claim that, wow, if there's a gun in your home, then there's a greater risk of an accident with a gun. Well, guess what? By that logic, if there's a swimming pool outside, then there's a greater risk of me drowning in that swimming pool. Or if there's a motorcycle in my house, then I have a greater risk of possibly being in a motorcycle accident. Yes, we get it. But don't those women matter? Or are they simply lumped into the same group of ladies who are supposedly incapable of thinking rationally or using a firearm for protection? On the contrary, I've heard hundreds of amazing stories about women who saved themselves and others because they had a firearm. So I'm going to stick to my guns and keep sharing my beliefs with others. I'm also going to stick to the reasoning of Annie Oakley, who so fittingly stated, "I would like to see every woman know how to handle firearms as naturally as they know how to handle babies." Until next time, stay safe and be well armed.
You can read more from Beth at usconcealedcarry.com/blog and click on Pacifiers and Peacemakers in the left sidebar.
This podcast runs on your donations. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the donate or the subscribe button in the right sidebar. You can make a one-time donation of any amount or subscribe for as little as $2 a month. That doesn't sound like much, but we pay our server costs monthly. A little help from you is a big help to us.
Felons behaving badly. Gastonia man stole pickup truck with child inside, led police on chase. A Gastonia man allegedly stole a pickup truck while the 3-year-old child was inside before leading police on an over 100-mile-per-hour chase on Saturday, according to the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office. Suspect 39 stole the Chevrolet Silverado from someone who had stopped to get gas and walked into the store at Will's Food Store on High Shoals around 9:45 a.m. The truck was chased by Gaston County police on several roads before entering York County on US 321. York County police assisted in the chase. Gaston County officers initiated a traffic stop on Myrtle School Road after they entered North Carolina and suspect ran. He was taken in custody shortly after officers chased him down on foot. Police said that the child was in good condition and their parents were taken to pick up the child and truck in Gaston County. Suspect was charged with felony counts of possession of stolen goods, abduction of a child, and larceny of a vehicle, and misdemeanor child abuse. He faces additional charges in Gaston County and was jailed on $60,000 bond. Now, Gaston County is in North Carolina. York County is in South Carolina. So the guy went across the border and came back. So this is like interstate kidnapping.
Yeah, that's federal.
Yeah, I wonder if they'll get him for that. I wouldn't mind.
So tell me, Sean, what kind of choir boy would engage in interstate kidnapping of a child?
Assault and battery, misdemeanor class 2. 3 counts, driver's license revoked, misdemeanor class 1. 2 counts of larceny, misdemeanor class 1. Open container after consuming, misdemeanor class 1. Possess stolen goods, misdemeanor class 1. Credit card theft, felon class I. Financial card fraud, felon class I. 2 counts, possess schedule 1, felon class I. Felony breaking and entering, felon class H. Larceny after breaking and entering, felon class H. And obtain property by false pretense, cheat services, felon class H.
Seems to me what we need here is common sense driver's license regulation. Because that would stop this.
I think so. If we can't even keep people out from behind the steering wheel of a car when they don't have a driver's license, how can we possibly stop the bigger crimes?
Exactly.
Baron is on assignment and will return soon.
Hey, this is Lloyd Bailey, the Armed Lutheran, host of the Armed Lutheran Radio Podcast, reminding you that the podcast you're listening to is a proud member of the Self-Defense Radio Network. Check out all the great content at selfdefenseradio.net.
Main topic. Aaron, I wonder if we're programming people to feel guilty about defending themselves.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Now, in the last, been a week? 2 weeks, I guess? We've had two high-profile defensive gun uses, and the reaction to it has been, you know, of course, concealed handgun permit holders and gun owners in general think this is a good thing, that the people carrying guns are defending themselves, or in one spectacular case, defending a Arizona state trooper. But the way people are talking about the aftermath of a defensive gun use really bothers me. The two defensive gun uses that I'm talking about, the first one is in Rolling Oaks Mall, and I believe that was in San Antonio, Texas. Everybody's heard the story, and this is also a cautionary tale on listening to the media before all the facts are out. What did we hear about that? We heard some guys were robbing a jewelry store, and some unarmed Good Samaritan tried to intervene. He got shot and killed. Somebody else shot at the robbers, shot one of them. The other guy ran off. They eventually captured the second guy, right?
That's one of the things. The other thing, I don't know if I heard this or if I just wasn't paying attention, but I thought that the concealed carrier is the one who was shot and killed.
Right. And I'd never heard that one, but it wouldn't surprise me, because everything gets mixed up. Important thing to remember here is everything is wrong in the initial reporting. Pretty much everything's wrong. Because what is the first thing that we heard? Mass shooting in a mall. So we've got rampage shooter shooting up a mall, killing a bunch of people. Oh, no, actually, it was a robbery in a jewelry store. No. It turns out that the person who was killed was a man named Jonathan Murphy. Jonathan and his wife, Amy, were in a jewelry store. It was a K Jewelers, I understand. And they were getting their wedding bands cleaned, right? Seriously? Getting your wedding bands cleaned and get killed. Ooh, this sucks. This is not much worse it can be, right?
Well, it's not like there's really a good time to get killed, but
there's a whole lot of ways that aren't going to feel quite as horrible.
Yeah.
Like, he's in there with his wife, with the wedding bands. I mean, I don't know about you, but whenever I'm, doing anything with my wedding band, I'm thinking about my wife. It's a, it's a special moment. Been married 10 years? Even still. Well, he's in there. They're getting their wedding bands clean. Two guys come in, waving guns, threatening, beating on the counter. Well, Jonathan Murphy steps in front of his wife. Apparently, his wife was between him and the robbers, so he moved to stand in front of her, and dude shot him. Shot him once in the chest, once in the head. If you watch the frankly horrific video of Amy Murphy talking about it and crying and just, having exactly the reaction you would expect, she's saying, I knew, but she's motioning to her head in a way that really evokes there were pieces of his head missing right in front of her. Well, at that point, a concealed carrier shoots the guy who did the shooting, and then they both flee. One of them, I guess, they caught inside the mall because he got shot and didn't get very far. The other guy was captured later. I think it was in a truck accident. I don't know. But they got both of them. They're both being charged with capital murder. Now, you're the concealed carrier in there. The first thing I'm thinking is was he outside the store? Was he in the store? If he was in the store, sees the guy get shot, but he's holding this gun. He's had this gun this whole time, and he hasn't made a move yet. But now he shoots. I mean, what's that going to feel like? Oh, should I have shot earlier? Should I have drawn immediately and shot? Or was he outside, and the guys were shooting as they came running out the door, and he just shot back at them, so he didn't see it happen? We don't know. We don't know any of this stuff. So figure the aftermath of that's not going to be pleasant. The other defensive gun use, I'm sure you've heard of this one, the one in Arizona.
Yeah, where the Arizona state trooper, I believe, was being beaten to death by somebody, and a Good Samaritan drove by, stopped the car, got out, told the guy to stop. The guy didn't stop. Guy actually had to go back to his car to get the pistol and shot the man who was assaulting the police officer.
Right. Now, why wasn't he carrying the gun? Well, he was on a stretch of road that was between whatever big city he was coming from, I think Phoenix, I'm not sure, and California. So he was going to California. He obviously, unless he's going to stop at the border, he's not going to take it off. So yeah, it's packed in his car safely where it belongs because he can't carry in California. Well, then we come to find out even more interesting information about the guy. The person who stepped in to save the police officer was a formerly prohibited person. He had been convicted of a felony. He'd done his time. He lived a number of years after that, hadn't done anything wrong, petitioned a judge, and the judge had the charge reduced from a felony to a misdemeanor and had his firearms rights restored, specifically because he said, "I used to shoot all the time. It was something I did. I want to do it again." And he got his firearms rights restored. And now something like, I think this happened in 2006, might have been 2003, that he got it back, 2008, I don't know. All these years later, he's in the right position to use his gun to save somebody's life. And you watch the video of him. He's not happy. You know, there's no dancing on the grave of his enemy. None of that. He's a mess. What brought this up, which made me think of this subject and what made me, I mean, frankly, want to rant about this, is somebody posted this, "Oh, it would be terrible if this ever happened, but I'm going to carry my gun because, you know, this is why, and but I know I'd feel bad about it." And I have a question. People who say that, aren't they just setting themselves up to feel bad? Aren't they telling themselves, "This must feel horrible. I know I'm going to..." So isn't that like a self-fulfilling prophecy?
Well, it sure sounds like it. But don't we? I mean, I've said this, you've said this, that taking a human life is not something to be treated lightly. So really, what's wrong with having a sober attitude towards this?
Except I'm not seeing a sober attitude towards it. What I'm seeing is a pervasive pressure that I am going to feel bad. You are going to feel bad. Your life is going to change. Everything is going to be horrible over and over and over again. I have never been to any discussion of self-defense, a shooting class where they talk about, where it's not just pure sport shooting. I'm talking like self-defense shooting. Everybody talks about, "Oh, it's going to be horrible. It's going to change your life." Well, of course it's going to change your life. You've never killed anybody before. It's going to be a little different. But do we have to tell people that they're going to be miserable? You just did something that saved an innocent person's life. There is no reason for you to feel bad about that. If you do feel bad, that's okay. You're allowed to feel bad. You're allowed to feel however you want, right?
Right.
I think you told me a little bit of something about, you know, people telling you how you must feel.
Yeah, that is something that bothers me. And I hate to constantly be banging on the transgender drum here, but this is very much within my wheelhouse because I firmly believe that no one except me has the right to tell me who I am. You know, I choose how I identify. I choose how I present myself to the world. No one else can force that upon me. Feelings are exactly the same way. I'm going to feel the way that I feel, and you don't get to tell me how I feel. Now, we can have an argument about how I'm processing those feelings, how those feelings are making me react to other people.
Right.
But you don't get to tell me, no, what you're feeling is bad and wrong, and you must be feeling something else instead.
Right. It's perfectly within our right to say, "Hey, you're being a jerk," because you're being a jerk to us.
Right.
But we can't tell you, "Well, you shouldn't feel that way. You should feel great," or "You should feel bad," or "You should feel purple." That doesn't make any sense. Why are we telling people beforehand that they must feel bad? You can tell them, "Hey, look, there's a range of feelings. There are people out there, and I know there are people out there who have shot people and have said it felt like taking out the trash. It was just something that had to be done, and I don't feel a thing about it." And there are other people out there who lose their freaking mind, literally lose their mind, have to go to the loony bin because it's so bad. You can feel however you like. I'm not going to judge. But you don't get to tell me beforehand, and you probably shouldn't tell other people beforehand, that they must feel bad. Now, there's an interesting story. If you ever meet Law Dog, and trust me, you should make every effort to meet Law Dog. The dude is hilarious and a really cool guy. But if you were ever privileged to spend a little time with Law Dog, I want you to ask him to tell you a story about some other officer that he knows who was dealing with a post-shooting stress. He told this story to us at Ambulance Driver's medical training class in Nashville at the NRA meeting. He said the officer was at a vending machine in a hallway, was buying something from the vending machine. Something caught his eye and he turned and blocked an incoming knife. The guy was stabbing. He made this motion of an overhead stab. Blocked it, drew his service weapon, and shot the guy, probably from close retention, I don't remember, and killed him deader than hell right there. Because of the way it happened and how quickly it happened, his mind was unable to remember anything other than the turning and shooting the guy. He didn't remember the knife. He didn't remember why he turned. He didn't know anything at all about the incident other than he turned and shot somebody. And then he was hit with this wave of excitement and elation. In his mind, he had turned for no reason and shot some innocent person standing next to him and then just loved it. Well, there's video evidence. There was video running in the hallway. They have the surveillance video. They see the guy coming. They see him sneaking up on the officer. They see him drawing the knife. They see him stabbing the guy, or trying to, and they see the officer shoot this guy dead. Perfectly justified shooting. There's no court in the world where you would be, no matter who you were, convicted of any sort of crime for doing this. But all he remembers is, I shot somebody and I feel great about it. Well, doesn't that, you know, if you're told, hey, you must feel bad, but you feel good because that's the natural chemical reaction. That's what happens when those chemicals drop on you. Oh, I won. I lived. And now you're supposed to feel bad, and everybody's told you you're supposed to feel bad. Now you got this conflict. Oh, am I a psychopath? Am I a horrible, murdering, nasty person because I felt good because I won a life and death conflict?
I feel bad because I don't feel bad.
Exactly. Why are you telling people they have to feel bad? If somebody deserved it and they did it to the person who deserved it, well, then they don't have to feel bad. And if you find yourself in that situation and you don't feel bad about it, hey, good for you. I'm not going to make you feel bad. I'm not going to tell you how you have to feel. And nobody else should either. And if you feel horrible about it and you need counseling, or you need to go spend a couple of weeks in a padded cell with a hug me coat on, hey, that's fine too.
I had a similar sort of experience, and I don't think I've ever told anyone about this publicly, but on 9/11, I was living in the DC metro area, and I was listening to the reports as the planes crashed. And intellectually, I knew this was a very bad thing, and I was angry, don't get me wrong here. But what my body was feeling was, for lack of a better word, excitement. It was that adrenaline dump. And it was sort of like when you're watching a movie and the bad guys have just done a terrible bad thing and the music starts and the heroes strike their pose and you know that major ass kicking is about to come down and you're sitting there, you're eating the popcorn and you're going, oh yeah, it's about to get real. Stuff's going to happen. Let's go. Come on. Let's do it.
Right.
And that's what I was feeling. And I felt a little awkward about that, which is why I haven't told people. But it was that, this is awful, but I can't wait to see what happens next.
Right, because you and I are pretty close to the same age. We both paid attention to that sort of thing and the terrorism and the violence. You lived in Germany. You were probably taught what to do in the event you were caught in a terrorist incident.
Yes, I was.
You and I have thought about terrorism and people attacking us, and we have watched for years at that point where we had done nothing. Well, there was no way there was nothing going to happen on that day. When that happened, it was all over. We knew someone was getting an ass whipping, and it was people who deserved that ass whipping and had deserved it for a long time and were going to get kicked. I remember, I think it was the same day, it might have been the next day, there's a song, something along the lines of, is everybody wants to kick some ass? I do. Who wants to see everybody kick their ass? I don't know what the song is. I can't sing it. I don't remember all the words. But I remember them playing that on the radio. And it was like, let's go kick some ass. So yeah.
I felt the same way with Let the Bodies Hit the Floor.
Right. And I didn't, you know, okay, there's some weird people who thought, well, you know, people jumping out of the towers, bodies hit the floor. But that's not what I was thinking. I was thinking, gonna go, you know, what's the guy from the guy, RTT, the RTT man guy.
Tap, tap, bang, bang, tap, tap, freaking slang body's gonna go.
That's what I was looking for. So yeah, I totally get that. And like, what, I'm supposed to feel bad because now, you know, hey, it's not something I can change. So now let's go make some people get hurt that deserved it and have deserved it for a long time.
Right.
I think this all comes from a study that pretty much everybody's heard from World War II that 75% of infantrymen in battle never fired their rifle at a person with the intention of killing him.
Well, with those odds, it makes me wonder how we managed to win the war in the first place.
Seriously, if 75% of the people were just shooting in the air or not shooting at all, how did we beat the Nazis? So I'm pretty sure the Nazis were convinced that more than 25% of the people were shooting back at them. I mean, seriously. Well, see, the study that this guy did, guy's name's S.L.A. Marshall, he did this study that regular units fired at about 75%, didn't shoot, and elite units, highly trained units, something like 50 or 70 or 80% shot. And that was the difference between regular units who weren't trained very well and highly specialized trained units like the Rangers or I don't know who. Like 80% of them would fire their gun. And that's the difference. So we needed to train people. Well, this information was taken by a guy named Colonel Dave Grossman, and he turned it into On Killing or something like that. And he spun this wild tale about how humans don't like to hurt each other. And therefore, in order to be more effective as a military, we have to condition them to want to hurt the enemy. So we needed to use silhouette targets that look like people. Because people won't shoot at people unless you train them to shoot at people. People won't hurt other people unless you train them that way. And I'm thinking, did this guy ever read history? How many dead bodies did we stack up over the last millennium or two? I mean, seriously. Well, it turns out, after he's built this giant edifice on top of the house of cards of S.L.A. Marshall's study, turns out S.L.A. Marshall made it up.
Wow, imagine that.
I know. Fake but accurate.
I mean, just look at how toddlers treat each other, for crying out loud.
Oh, my God.
They're trying to kill each other.
Seriously, you spend the first 18 years of, or probably longer than that, of any boy, certainly, and most of the girls too, their life trying to condition them into not being murderous little turds. Can't say what I wanted to say. Seriously, we are a violent species. Not only are we violent, we like violence. We enjoy it. Take a look. Now, you've been conditioned, don't hurt people. You've been told, don't hurt people. You've been given a series of rules that say, here's when it's acceptable. If you're lucky, you've been given the rule that says, this is when it's acceptable, but in all other circumstances, don't. So just because you get people telling you that based on this false study, most people don't want to hurt other people, doesn't mean that you need to feel guilty because all these people tell you, you need to feel guilty. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. Stop telling people to feel guilty. Feel how you feel. If you feel guilty, hey, that's okay. You can feel guilty. If you don't feel guilty, that's okay too. All any of us really ask is that you be moral and follow the law. If the guy deserved getting shot, okay. That's good enough for us. You're not required to feel guilty too. How many people want to kick some
ass? I do. Tiffany is on assignment and will return next week.
And now it's time for Blue Collar Prepping with that bratty kid sister of the gun blogosphere, Erin Paulette.
Come on, everypony! It's time for Blue Collar Prepping with Erin Paulette!
Throughout the course of doing these Blue Collar Prepping segments, I have constantly preached that preppers need to maintain secrecy about the extent of their preps, and perhaps even hide the fact that they are preppers at all. And the reason for this is simple. If it's known that you prep and your friends and neighbors don't, then those people will likely show up on your doorstep wanting some of your supplies after a disaster. And I have said multiple times that it's between you and your conscience whether or not you send them away. My point has always been that it needs to be your choice to share with others. If an entire neighborhood of hungry people shows up on your front yard demanding food, you don't have a choice to share with them. Really, the only choice you have boils down to, do I let them break in and take the food my family needs? Or do I have to threaten to shoot them to make them go away? However you choose, your secret is out and you have to deal with the consequences. I say that it's better to stay deep within the prepping pantry because if people don't know, they can't threaten you with violence if you don't give up the resources you've carefully stored. But this approach is invariably met with a question, but if I see someone in need and I can help them, shouldn't I? And while I can't answer for you, my response is almost always no. Preppers need to learn to say no, because that can be a potentially life-saving skill. I call this the audacity of nope. And it does take audacity, because the natural human response is to help someone in need. Now, let me be clear about this. I absolutely encourage preppers to help other people whenever possible. That's just common decency. However, if you've ever taken a first aid class or a rescue swimming class or anything else like that, recall that you are always taught that you should never, ever endanger yourself to help another. Because if you put yourself in danger and fail, there are now two people who need rescue, and you've just made the situation worse. Prepping is like that, only with potentially higher stakes. If you have a family, it is your duty to protect them before you protect other people. And if you allow other people to partake of your supplies, then you are, in fact, depriving your family of those supplies which might be needed later. Worse, imagine if you give food to someone who needs it, and then they tell other people where they got it. What's to keep those other people from walking up and asking for the same thing? It is not your responsibility to feed the neighborhood. And this is why I believe that preppers need to learn to say no. Internalize this lesson now, because you do not need to be learning it when it's life or death. So here are the steps I recommend preppers take to learn how to nope out of situations. First, learn to live the phrase, "not my circus, not my monkeys." In other words, if something doesn't immediately affect you, stay out of it. And this is desirable on several levels. It breaks you of a habit of getting involved in other people's business and cleaning up other people's messes. It prevents you from looking like a busybody. And it gives you more time and energy to devote to more important tasks, like prepping or your family. Next, embrace the notion that it isn't your job to save everyone. In fact, it is physically impossible to save everyone. Your only job in this world is to take care of yourself and those who you love or who depend on you. Everything after that is a secondary concern. Now, some may call that being selfish. I call it self-love. You don't want your family homeless or starving because you decided that feeling better about yourself for doing something nice was more important than security. To me, that is the height of selfishness. Finally, take the time now to teach other people how to prep. This will not only ease your conscience later on. They had every opportunity to look after themselves, and I tried to show them how. It's not my fault if they didn't listen. But this is also looking after yourself in the long term, because if everyone around you is prepared, then not only do you not need to worry about them using your supplies or equipment because they have their own, you have taken the first step in forming a prepping community that can depend on each other. So do these three things now, so that if you ever need to harden your heart and say no later, it won't hurt as much.
Not only can you subscribe or donate to the podcast, you can also make a contribution to the LGBT Training Ammo Fund. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the LGBT Training Ammo Fund donation button in the right sidebar. I'll use this money to pay for range fees, targets, and yes, ammo for the people I teach. And thanks for your support. The Loaded Conversations podcast is back, this time with an interview with Harvard professor and anti-gun nut David Hemenway in This Week in Anti-Gun Nuttery. So hey, Weird, what do you got for me this week?
The Loaded Conversations podcast is back again. Seems like she's in a groove of 30 minutes of podcast every month. Okay, you've heard my gloating before, so let's just dive right in. This month's show is an interview. Who's the subject?
David Hemenway is a researcher and professor of health policy with Harvard University's School of Public Health. In 2006, he published Private Guns, Public Health, a pragmatic, science-based approach to reducing injuries and deaths from gun violence.
So David is one of those guys who wants to look at gun control from the standpoint of epidemiology. As if gun violence and the bird flu have a damn thing in common. He's also a former employee of the Brady Campaign, whom Miss Flowers, who does this podcast, currently works for. As for his science-based approach to gun control, I'll show you what a great scientist he is.
In my interview with him, David talks about his work with Ralph Nader in reducing motor vehicle injuries and deaths, and how that can help us understand gun safety and firearm regulation.
Except Ralph Nader was exposed as a crackpot for his crusade against American automobiles. His methods were flawed, he ignored German cars with nearly identical problems, and he inflated minor issues into catastrophic problems. You think Facebook is pushing fake news? Ralph Nader was writing fake news before you were born!
Which means before you were born!
And Ralph Nader is used as a resume point for this guy? Doesn't that just set the mood? Now on to Hemingway's own work.
We start out by talking about the fact that crime rates here in the U.S. and around the world have actually gone down. Hemingway was part of a task force convened to figure out why this was.
We looked at it over two dozen reasons and whatever, and I think it's fair to say that we concluded that we have no idea. We just don't know.
Again, what we've been saying all along, there are no ties to violent crime and guns. None. But these are anti-gun nuts we're dealing with.
My pet one was that most other people didn't like at all, was sort of contagion. When there's more crime, and that leads to more crime, which leads to more crime. You know, when there's gun violence, you know, there's retaliation for the gun violence, which is retaliation for, then there's retaliation. When some kids get guns, other people need guns, which means, other gangs. So you have this, like an epidemic.
Note this was an international task force, so many of the scientists who were telling Hemingway he was full of crap were from countries that banned guns and had no understanding of the right to keep and bear arms. He's just an agenda-driven nut who wants to jump to conclusions first, then hunt for supporting evidence second. Real scientists hate this crap.
I've heard it applied certainly to school shootings and about how that has its own kind of contagion.
Yep. You know? No, I think that's right. I think there is. I think there's no question that there's some contagion in it.
He thinks that there's a school shooting contagion? This is the level of lunacy we're dealing with here. For there to be a contagion, there first would need to be a rise in school shootings. Yes, anti-gun groups like Michael Bloomberg and Mother Jones have reported a rise in school shootings. But it just isn't so. The only way they got to those numbers was to lump in huge numbers of cases that the average person wouldn't count as a school shooting. Things like suicide on campus or gang activity in the area around a school. Is it too much to assume that a Harvard professor specializing in this should know his facts? I do assume he knows, but he ignores the facts that refute his agenda. Now onto some real garbage.
The trucks provide enormous benefits, and cars provide enormous benefits. But they provide some costs, right? And one of the costs is people dying from crashes. Guns provide lots of costs and some benefits. I mean, and you know, people like the target shoot, and they have fun, lots of. I mean, it's like going bowling.
It's just like bowling. It's just bowling. It's all about bowling. I like to go bowling. That's why I need my guns. You stay away from my guns. I like to bowl. So he starts out reasonably. Cars and trucks are just one of those things that bring solutions to societal problems while causing a whole new set of problems. They really are very much like guns in that sense. Of course, now you see how on the level he is about guns. The only benefit to gun ownership is it's fun to target shoot? What about self-defense?
Certainly not public health benefits. I mean, you can argue on occasion that there's been such good self-defense gun uses that if you had mace, you wouldn't have done as good, been as well off.
Yep, he's going to discount 100,000 to 2 million defensive gun uses per year. We tackled this back in episode 111 of this show, when again it was David Hemingway disregarding defensive gun use to preach gun control. So despite it being an infinitesimal number compared to suicide and gang violence, David really wants to spend some time worrying about accidental death. Specifically, the even smaller subset that is accidental death of children. So what does he propose to help prevent gun accidents?
Basically, you make it so you have childproof guns. We did that, 100 years ago.
Childproof guns. What he's talking about were the first firearms to incorporate safety in their design. Designs like gripped safeties and drop safeties on handguns. And these features were heavily advertised. These are features that still exist today. Why does he talk like they don't exist?
One of the big things they could do is do research on and figure out smart guns. Guns which only can be used by the owner.
Yeah.
And so that would help reduce accidents, it would help reduce suicide.
Because anti-gunners have moved the goalposts. Now you just can't have a gun that's guarded against malfunctions and accidental discharge. It needs to be usable by only the owner. Never mind that other people shoot my guns all the time. It's part of gun culture and teaching safety. Not to mention that mandating single-user smart guns would make safety training extremely difficult. Never mind that law enforcement and military always demand that they be exempted from this technology because they don't want a piece of technology to fail when their lives depend on it. Never mind that the vast majority of suicides by gun are committed by the authorized owners of those guns. And of course, this makes guns more expensive and therefore less accessible to the people who need them. What other gun safety advice does he have for us?
So the kid gets his dad's semi-automatic, and, you know, he's 13-year-old, he finds it, he plays with it, and he takes out the magazine, he thinks it's unloaded, here's all the bullets in his one hand, the gun's in the other hand, he pulls the trigger, and there's a bullet left in the chamber, and it goes off, and it kills his best friend. But, you know, you blame the kid, you can blame the parents, or you can solve the problem, which is make it so when you take out the magazine, the gun doesn't shoot.
Ah, magazine disconnects. The safeties that aren't. There is no safety feature that will correct for poor weapon handling. Any gun that will poke a hole in a piece of paper or a violent attacker will also shoot something you don't want destroyed. The only way to avoid this is proper safety training, and relying on dubious safety features will only make it worse. The only arguments in favor of magazine disconnects are police being able to disable their gun in the dubious scenario where they are about to lose control of their firearm, but still have enough control of their gun to dump the mag, and bad gun handling. Arguments against them is it makes clearing a firearm that much more complicated, adding the counterintuitive step of reinserting the magazine to drop the hammer or striker, which is just foolish. It adds a level of complexity to the gun that greatly hinders reliability. And if you mandate this feature, you're either going to have to grandfather in all the guns that aren't safe, or ban just about everything on the market while gun makers hop around trying to squeeze a magazine disconnect into a gun that was never meant to have one. So, more expensive and less accessible.
The manufacturers could make it so it helped the police in terms of, you know, reducing crime by catching criminals, which to make it so you could easily trace the bullet to the gun.
He's talking about microstamping, a patented technology that could only be produced by one for-profit company at a very non-trivial price. A dubious technology that even in ideal laboratory conditions frequently produces illegible stamps. A technology that can be removed from the gun with equipment that can be bought at most grocery stores. And it can be done in less time than you've been listening to this podcast. This adds price and complexity to the firearm, so more expensive and less accessible. And the anti-gun reaction to all this crap?
Why would they not do that? Is it just expensive and they just don't give a shit and they don't have to?
Yeah.
This is the ivory tower of anti-gun nuttery. They don't listen to our podcasts. They don't talk to us. Anti-gun nuts just talk to other anti-gun nuts. And between them, they decide what us booger-eating gun nuts think. Plus, yes, everything you propose is more expensive to a product that really isn't cheap to begin with. That means the poor people living in violent cities will have less access to life-saving tools. So in case you weren't 100% convinced that David Hemenway had no right to talk about the gun issue, it's not just guns he's totally clueless about.
Let's put roundabouts in places where people seem to be crashing into each other at stop signs.
I'm a resident of Massachusetts. So is David. How could he say this? Roundabouts are lawless disaster areas. Does he not even drive in Massachusetts?
Possible steering columns are really great. I mean, why should you be impaled on your steering column in a head-on collision if you're the driver? But it doesn't help the person in the, you know, passenger seat, or it doesn't help the bicyclist, da 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 da.
Of course a collapsible steering column does nothing for a person riding a bike. They aren't going to get impaled on a steering column. This is one of those great academic minds that the anti-gun side has to offer. Would you trust him with public safety policy?
All right, Weird. It was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
In addition to appearing here, Weird is a regular host on The Squirrel Report and blogs at weirdworld.com. That's W-E-E-R-D world.com.
Plug of the week, Covington Vodka. So, Aaron, you're a grown-up. Do you ever drink any adult beverages?
Well, the fact of me being grown up is in dispute, but as a legal adult, yes, I really enjoy the rum.
Ever have any vodka? Like vodka at all?
I have drunk vodka. Vodka's just sort of there, you know? It doesn't have any taste. You have to add stuff to it. So yeah. I'm sure I've had it.
Yeah, I think you're probably right on that. Most of the time, if I drink anything at all with vodka, it's vodka in something, like, you know, last night, vodka and orange juice. But since I carry a gun all the time, I rarely drink because I just don't like to drink when I, you know, I used to live in Pennsylvania. It was perfectly legal to be drunk and carry a gun. I just didn't feel comfortable doing it. But every now and then, I like to have something. In my regular work life, I visited Covington Vodka site in Snow Hill, North Carolina, which is about an hour or so from my house. And they, you know, they had all the stuff up on the wall, buy Covington Vodka, this, that, and the other stuff. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. On my way home, I pass an ABC store and I picked up a bottle. Conflict of interest rules mean that I can't take them as a gift, right? You see how that works? It kind of,
yeah.
I know. I'm pretty sure they would have been happy to hand over one of the little mini bottles of the stuff, but I'm like, yeah, you know, that's not going to work. I just can't. But the wife likes vodka, so I thought, eh, I'll pick up a bottle, see if it's any good. The wife, who is the official vodka tester, pronounced it damn good vodka and really smooth. This is apparently good for vodka that it's really smooth, I guess.
I guess as long as it doesn't taste like brake cleaner, it's fine.
It's not supposed to taste like anything, I thought. That's why I don't get flavored vodkas. I thought the point of vodka was that it didn't taste like anything. I don't know. In any case, she said it was really good, but she still twitches whenever I repeat the tagline, the best yam vodka on earth. It's made with sweet potatoes. And the wife is like, girl, no, it's not yam vodka. It's made with sweet potatoes. Something, something South America, something, something Africa. I don't know. It's like a clip versus magazine thing for biology people. Apparently, there's a difference between yams and sweet potatoes. It was the stuff that I never ate that was served to me at Thanksgiving ever since I was a child. And they called it yams when I was in California. And they call them sweet potatoes out here. I don't know. You know, I never really liked them. But you know what? Turned them into vodka. It's pretty good. So anyway, if you live in North Carolina, you can pick up a bottle at the ABC store. I paid $32 for a bottle of it. It was, you know, fifth. So it's not frat boy party vodka. It's, you know, premium stuff. And it's also, it's gluten-free, non-GMO, and certified kosher, if any of that means anything to you. You know what? If it's, I don't know if it's kosher for Passover, though. But Jewish people like to drink, right?
Oh, do they?
And because it's made with sweet potatoes and not with wheat.
It's gluten-free.
It's gluten-free. So anybody who happens to be gluten-free, Brita, there you go. There's some vodka for you. So outside of North Carolina, you can actually buy it at a place called Ezra's. That's EZRAS.com. Or just go to your local store and see if they can get you some. Check out Covington Vodka at CovingtonVodka.com. That's CovingtonVodka.com. Well, that's our show for the week. Remember that the Gunblog Variety Cast is a member of the Self-Defense Radio Network.
Find the show notes at gunblogvarietycast.com/episode128.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Gunblog Variety Cast. Music courtesy of Rob Allen at blog.roballen.com. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Play Music. This podcast is made possible by the Firearms Policy Coalition and by contributions from listeners like you. This is a URS production.